we have four guys here who work for a little company called Atari. You may have heard of it. We have Mr. Al Alcorn, who put together some game which had paddles and a pong sound. I don't know. Mr. Steve Mayer, he worked for the Grants Valley unit, where they came up with something called the 2600. Maybe you heard of that. Then the newer Atari people, we have Mr. Bill Reebok, who was the VP of Software Business Development for the Tremel Atari. And lastly, we have John Scrutch, who he was head of Atari Soft. And I say lastly loosely because he was the last person with Atari. He was the last person out the door.
I turned the lights off.
So, the Atari guys.
Well, I guess I'll start, and I guess what we'll do here is I'll talk for a little bit, and then I guess we'll let everybody say a little piece, and then we'll open up to questions. Does that sound good? So I just thinking back, I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to be alive. I'm glad to see a lot of my old friends. Atari, I was very fortunate to be part of that, to be selected to do that. I guess I'll tell you how it happened that I came to work at something called Atari. I was going to school at Cal Berkeley back in the 60s, in the middle of all the fun times, and I wound up having a job, work-study job at Ampex, 1968, where I met Steve Mayer back there in 68. That's a long time for the Valley. So back when there were still orchards and it wasn't called Silicon Valley. And we worked in a group called Videophile that had some of the people that invented videotape recording were in that group. And I think it was a pretty neat team. Nolan was in that team and whatnot. And I went back to Cal. And one thing led to another. Back in 1972, I was back at Ampex 71. And Nolan had left, and the word had gotten out that Nolan Bushnell had this crazy idea for a coin-operated video game, and he went off to the one company on the West Coast that was making video games, was Nutting Associates. They had a game called Computer Quiz, which was a film strip projector, and you'd guess you had four questions, and it would ring a buzzer or something if you got a wrong answer. But the good feature of the company, it was in Santa Clara, and they sold coin-op video games. They had distribution. So Nolan had this prototype of this crazy game, Computer Space, and convinced Bill Nutting that they should build it. So Nolan quit a good job at Ampex. He just started there, and this was like a career move. And so he became their engineer, and they built him and Ted Dabney went off, and they built this thing, and it did okay. They sold a few thousand of them, but it was not a big hit. But it was clearly a genre that worked, and Nolan did not want to work any longer for them. It's another story. He got a dispute with them, so he started this company on his own called Syzygy, S-Y-Z-Y-G-Y. And I was working at Ampex at the time, and we were still friends, and I got a call from Nolan. Ampex was having trouble at that time. So I got a call from Nolan, going to have lunch with Nolan. So this is great. So Nolan and Ted show up, take me to lunch, and they're driving a company car, which is now, this is 1972. I'm going, wow, a company car. What's this, a free car? You get to drive a car, you have to pay for it. It's brand new. Wow, it was a Buick station wagon. I remember blue. It was really neat. So this sounds like fun, and would I want to work for them? They offered me $1,000 a month salary, and a bunch of stock. Well, I figured the company's going to go bankrupt in a year or two, and $1,000 a month was less than I was making. I was making $1,200 a month at Ampex. But I figured, what the heck? I'm young. It'll be fun. It'll tank. I'll go back to work at Ampex, and I'll have learned something. And that was my plan. And Nolan gave me this crazy snippet game to design, the simplest thing you can think of. Just one thing, one spot moving. And I think now, as I've heard Nolan talk about this, at first Nolan used to deny that he saw the Odyssey came from Magnavox. Well, they got his signature in a book. I mean, clearly he saw it. It was going on. But it wasn't a great game. It wasn't a great hit at all. And this was like the movie The Producers, because Nolan, this is a very simple game. He gives it to me. It tells me he's got a consumer contract from General Electric to build this game. And I'm like, I believe this. He wants me to work real hard on it. Now, nobody ever came by or wrote us a letter or called us from GE, but I was too busy building this thing to notice the difference. And Nolan figured I'd get done with it quickly, I'd learn the techniques, and then he'd give me the real game. It was more complex in Computer Space. That was his plan. And, well, it turned out that this game seemed to work okay. But the problem was, it was like the movie The Producers. Like, if you stole something that wasn't any good on a flop, so what? What damage? What could go wrong? Well, all of a sudden, the thing takes off. Right, and now we're building this thing, which is in a way sort of a kind of a copy of that game out there. That really wasn't the intention, but you know, like any startup company, to be successful, you got to be flexible. So when people wanted that, that's what we're building, and from then on, Nolan, that was his plan all along, of course. But the truth was that it was really just an exercise, and it got out of hand. So that's Atari. So,
Steve, I think one of the things that's sort of consistent with all the panels is the sense of people working with friends. There was no video industry at that point. It was a group of 20-something-year-olds doing, getting together. We assumed we were going to fail. We always had plan A, plan B. We actually started multiple companies so that no, that were all, they all had different names so that no two were on credit hold at the
right.
same time.
Cyan Engineering. Yeah.
And there's a tremendous liberation going into a place, a market where there was no market, so it didn't make any difference what we did. And to be 20 years old, and if you failed, so what? You were with friends. You could go ahead and start another company. So we had always assumed that that we were going to fail, and we would then restart the same company with a new group of people. We also had another dream that if we were wildly successful, that Disney or Bally was going to buy us.
We'd be rich.
And we'd be rich. So this gave us a tremendous flexibility of to try anything and everything. One time we did a coin-op drunk meter. So the idea was you were going to go into a bar and you would blow into this breathalyzer to find out how drunk you were, whether to drive your car or not. Unfortunately, people would blow in this and to see how high they could run the meter. So this was not a good idea. Then there was a whole series of other really bad ideas. We decided to help the hearing impaired so that we had this tablet, and you could write out help, and then you could flip it over to the other side. And this cost like $400 or $600, and it was a poor replacement for a pencil and paper. But I think the idea that we could fail on these things was a tremendous liberation, because then we were allowed to succeed. The VCS, one of the things I was allowed to do, that the whole 2600 was really done as a project over a period of about 10 weeks to see if it was feasible or not. And over 10 weeks, we were able to build a prototype and actually do the first programming of it. And then it became enormously successful. I didn't know it was going to be enormously successful. Al went to work for $1,000 a month. I had the choice of working for, I think it was close to $1,000 a month, or getting 3% royalties on anything I worked on. This was a tough negotiation, so I went for the $1,000 a month because, you know, because we assumed that none of this was going to pan out for anything.
Ouch.
But we went ahead and did the VCS, and it was enormously successful. But then right after that, we did a thing. I think there's a prototype of video music out there. And that sold, what, 70 or 80?
Maybe.
70 or 80. So here was the guy from Sears at Nolan's Chateau. And this guy from Sears was on an incredible run because we made him famous. He was the product manager for the VCS, and he came out to Atari to see what the new thing that his whole life was going to, you know, was going to be his next career, you know. And the video music, which is sort of puts up psychedelic things on the TV screen. And he looked over and he said, "What were you guys on? What were you smoking when you did this?" And the engineer next to him said, "This, you want some?" But even as we started getting large, we still kept that sense of anything was possible. There's a lot of companies that were able to bet everything when they had nothing. I think the magic of Atari was not only that it bet everything when it had nothing during the early days, but the middle days, in the 1980s, actually late 70s, that Nolan and Al and the group still were willing to bet everything just betting on the people, because if it failed, so what? We were going to go ahead and get our friends together and do the company over again.
I'll go next. I was originally moved out from Chicago to Sunnyvale in late 1990 to promote and foster the Atari ST and what was just on the horizon, the 68030-based TT for the use of desktop publishing, and to better foster the developer relations with that whole computer line. And it was very interesting because at the time you had Apple that was starting to make some pretty significant progress with the Mac and everything. But the thing that was kind of interesting was we really drove the market to the point where in the heyday of the 32-bit systems, both Playboy Germany as well as Volkswagen wound up having a bunch of their graphics workstations centered around Atari product, which was pretty wild. Then the Taiwanese PC manufacturers really, really started making significant inroads. A lot of the Mac developers were starting to wind up moving over to the PC. And I can remember the day that Jack said, these Taiwan guys, we're never going to be able to compete with them. And you know what? IBM's never going to be able to compete with them. So what the heck? Let's start focusing on the game console stuff again. And the projects like Panther and Jaguar all came out of that. And the ST and the TT, when they got closer to their end of product life, I can remember the one day, and I still think it was just by coincidence that I happened to be sitting right around the corner of the table from Jack in the boardroom, as I can't remember the one guy's name that was doing Jaguar software at the time, the first guy with the curly gray hair. He was only around for a couple months. I went through five general managers during the time that I was at Atari. You remember, it was Rick Randy or something?
Oh, God, I can't.
You know who I'm talking about.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
So anyway, so he got fired that morning. And we're sitting around, and Augie Liguori, who's the CFO, and he works for the World Wrestling Federation, now in New York. He's sitting next to me, and Jack, as he's going through all the changes that are going to go on, he looks at me and says, Mr. Raybock, I have not discussed this with the board, but you're now going to be Mr. Jaguar. And Augie said, oh, by the way, Bill, this is not something you can say no to. So we were launching Jaguar like in a week. And I... So the things that burn in my memory from that week were, number one, sitting in Sam Trammell's office with Leonard Trammell and Richard Miller, discussing whether or not it was safe to release the system with the jump instruction broken.
Right.
and Richard saying, no, I think it'll be okay. And I was new to the job, so I just said, okay, I'll go with you guys. But immediately after that, the next trip that I made was up to LucasArts. One of the guys there was a beta tester for this game on the PC called Doom. And he said, you got to see this. I'm probably not really supposed to show it to you, but I think that it'll all be okay because, it's going to be a good thing for everybody involved. So Michael Hay Hutchinson shows me Doom in his office at LucasArts, and I called up id the following day saying, hi, interested in seeing this. I'd like to talk to you about this. We got this wacky new video game system that we're launching, and we'd like to license it. So I flew down there and didn't know that our sort of comrades in Chicago had begun doing a deal for Wolfenstein on Lynx that they had never gotten clearance and had never had sign-off from the Trammells. So they pulled the deal at the last minute And Jay Wilbur and John Carmack were really ticked off. And if you've seen Doom, it's a sight to behold when you're sitting in this office with all of the artwork of Doom sitting around you and having these guys that really want to slit your throat because they just got shafted for about $40,000+ at the time.
Right.
And I said, well, oops, sorry. I didn't have anything to do with that. Trust me on this one. This is going to be a good thing. So right there on the spot, we did the deal, and John Carmack signed up to actually do the development on it, which wound up being the very last game console that he ever wrote code for. So I don't know if that says that he just enjoyed it so much that his life was fulfilled at that point, or that he just never wanted to look at another console again. But, the remarkable thing about it, talking about the friends that you make in the industry and everything else, I mean, so right now, today, I'm director of developer relations for NVIDIA, and it's all full circle. I just came back from QuakeCon last week, launching Doom 3, and also do a lot of work with Jay Wilbur, who's now at Epic Games doing Unreal and all the Unreal Engine 3 on all the NVIDIA products today. So it's like you just can't get away from these people. Although it's been a lot of been a lot of fun. So
my turn. I'll
turn it over to you.
Cool. Well. As everyone has stated, it's a human industry, and things get done as much for friendship and hatred and greed and joy and just the creative experience as dollars and cents. And at the end of the line at Atari. I know that some people have wondered about, well, gee, what is this hard drive thing? And, what in the world happened? And I don't know if it really is generally known or not, but in 1996, the company was doing okay, not great. And we had just gotten a large infusion of cash from our friends at Sega because of a little idea of being able to move an object and scroll it on the screen that some previous Atari guys had come up with. And, every darn video game scrolls, So we were holding that patent and with a tight fist. So we were sitting cash rich. Sam Trammell has a heart attack. And Sam Trammell is a year younger than me, and it scared the heck out of him. And it not only scared the heck out of him, it scared the heck out of Jack Trammell, who's his dad, and Sam was the president of the company. And so Jack came in, took over running the company while Sam was recuperating from his heart attack. And Jack is not a video game guy by any way, shape, or stretch of the imagination. He always used to say, I don't understand this stuff, So what he looked for was a way to kind of put the company in what he thought was in a safe place, which to him meant dealing with product that was brown box, a commodity, didn't need marketing, was just a thing that he could sell on price, which is what he learned and figured out at Commodore. So through whatever means, he got in touch and got in contact with Jugi Tandon Storage. And if you don't know, Jugi Tandon is the guy that invented the 1050 disk drive and invented double-sided, double-density floppies. So getting together with him, which was easy because he knew him, again, from previous contacts, and a guy by the name of Jim Mitchell, who was very instrumental at Seagate and at Connor, also happened to keep a hand grenade in his desk drawer, which was kind of exciting. The guy was a Marine from the word go, and working with him was actually worse than working with Jack Trammell. It was pretty amazing. But what happened in 96, Jack took the money we got from Sega and gave it to JTS and merged with and into JTS. And we took the company down from being on 1196 Borregas and having, I'm not really sure how many at the time, but maybe 100 people? maybe something like that, to 20. So there was 20 of us that they moved into the old B of A building on Matilda Avenue, still had the bank vault door in one of the well, actually still the bank vault, actually kept office supplies in there, which was a good safe place to put your pens and pencils. The door was about that thick.
Jack did not want people stealing
office supplies. No, do not steal office supplies. That's money. So continued to do development, actually, at the time. Breakout 2000 was still in process. I was still working on that at the time. We were working on Formula One Racer. We were working on the Iron Soldier 2. And, in fact, we finished Breakout 2000 and said, Jack, we're ready to go and manufacture. And he said, no. He said, well, we could make EEPROMs. He said, no. Said we could put them in paper bags and sell them on the street corners. He said no. So that pretty much ended development. What we ended up doing at that time, I was made director of product licensing. So at that time, we were dealing with companies like MGA, doing keychain games and LCD games. There was a company in the UK that started doing Atari shirts again. And two of their shirts ended up in a video for Atari Teenage Riot, I think it was the name of the group. And all of a sudden, the market busted open for new Atari shirts, which was kind of cool. There was another company wanting to do a Ralph Lauren high-end line of clothing with the Atari name on it. I thought they were crazy, but, you know, what the heck, their money was good. We had Microsoft still publishing Microsoft Arcade, which was the little floppy for the PC, and we were still making thousands of dollars a month on that. So we were kind of living on the licensing stuff. When the company merged in 96, they moved the last five of us over to the JTS building in Bay Point Parkway in San Jose. And it was kind of sad because they took the money and they really didn't care about Atari. I had collected all of the awards and trophies and things that we had won, and I asked if we could, you know, put up some bookcases and put the trophies and things in, you know, try and get some camaraderie going. And no, that was not okay. A couple Jaguar kiosks, and we had one or two of them in the cafeteria was not an okay idea. They basically had me in a cubicle in the back by the clean room. Doing licensing. And during that time, we were still making $1 million to $2 million dollars a year in revenue from things like Interplay, taking Tempest 2000 and putting it on the PlayStation 2 and stuff. And during that time, I was speaking with Hasbro because they wanted to license Centipede and I forget which other title for their line because they were doing Frogger. And we got to talking, and they said, well, you know, gee, how about if we just buy the whole thing rather than license it? So we worked out a deal, and I have to tell you that what I did try to do, in all honesty, was put Atari back together because I had discussions with Atari Games, which was one-third of Atari, and the Trammells bought two-thirds of Atari. And it was like, hey, Dan Van Eldren, who was the president of Atari Games at that time, let's put it back together. Let's make it one company again. And Midway, being actually cheaper than Jack, cheesed out on the deal to the tune of $500,000. So couldn't put it back together. Hasbro had the better deal. And we did a deal in February of 98 with the two major law firms here in the area, Wilson Sonsini and Cooley Godward. And it's the only license agreement that I've ever been involved with where I'm actually mentioned personally. It was kind of wild because the JTS management had no clue on you know what the intellectual property of Atari was. And so they said, well, you know, the management of Atari certifies this is good, and John Scratch. Because I was the only guy that really knew what it was. So I had to sign that thing, which was really scary, but I did. And Hasbro ended up with the property. And at that point, JTS said,
hey, Scratch, great job, but, you know, there's just not that much left here for you to do, being an Atari guy and all. So on your way out, would you mind turning the light out in your office? And so ended Atari at JTS. They went belly up a few months later, and the only other guy there, Don Thomas's stuff on Icy Wind is slightly wrong in that when I left, the only other guy from Atari who wasn't really doing Atari work was a warehouse guy, Sammy Delgado. So Sammy was still in the warehouse, but he'd been doing JTS stuff for months. But the last, you know, guy doing Atari things was me, and I dutifully turned the lights out, saving energy, and that was 98 in April of 98. You know, I don't know if that's public knowledge or not.
Yeah.
Then it must be public knowledge. Yeah, it was very cheap.
Very cheap.
But
and which made it so amazing that for 10% more, Midway didn't take it.
What were some of the difficulties working with Nolan as opposed to working with like Frank Zahar?
No, they were. Ray was better dressed. I think one of the two most important things were Nolan, when he would walk through the lab, when Al would allow him to walk through the lab, because one of the jobs Al had was to lock the door of the lab so that we could actually get a project from start to finish without having a change along the way. But Nolan loved the business, loved the products. He was a gamer. If there was two flies on the wall, he would be betting which fly would take off before the other one. During the Kassar days, they had a meeting of the management of Atari, and 2,000 people were in this room, and that's, first of all, an indication, you know, of where Atari was, you know, having 2,000 managers. And he asked how many people there played video games or had one of the Atari computers. I think only two or three people raised their hand out of these several thousand. So it ceased being a company by people that love games and into a money machine. And I think that was the thing. Ray himself was brilliant in terms of taking games and marketing them. When Ray pioneered the whole idea of marketing for video games, we had a marketing budget that got up to about $100 million a year, which was enormous in those days. And we had a brand recognition of 97%. It was second only to Coca-Cola worldwide. There were Atari Democrats. So, but he had no history of from the game business. He had no history of starting something small and nurturing it and then seeing what happens. This is also true of Warner to a slightly different extent. The idea of that they had never gone through industries emerging from the very beginning and going through a life cycle and becoming mature because, you know, they've made records, you know, and records didn't change that much over a period of time. So they had no idea how volatile things could be. They thought that we were really changing the world, that this was that, and that the games industry was just going to grow linearly into the far world, and they had no idea that market shares wouldn't. Ray came out of consumer marketing, where if Pepsi-Cola changed by 3% market share, you know, that was the world's changing. There was no model of that things could drop by 80% or 90% in 1 year.
Yeah, when Ray really, as you said, really understood marketing a product, which with our solution would be to build a new product, mm-hmm. which, and that's probably one of the main, that was the main argument. Nolan and Joe wanted to drop the VCS. It didn't take off very well, and the solution was simply to engineer something better. And Warner wisely said, no, we're going to go with this product, and it was a big product. But the other way of saying it was there was this Silicon Valley style, which Atari kind of created, and you things are moving so fast in technology that if you didn't, you know, obsolete yourself, somebody else would. And Ray and his and his managers came from a world where that wasn't so. I mean, you had a product, a brand of a product, and it ran forever, and you just ran it. And the idea that it would die in a year or two after all this money was just foreign. They didn't really understand that concept, and that led to, really, fundamentally led to the demise. But it was kind of depressing when you go into the executives. When Nolan, you go into Nolan's office, when Nolan was there, there'd be weird games. There'd be Polynesian games. There'd be, you know, any kind of weird thing, because he was like this. And I got this thing in production, but Nolan would have all these new ideas. When Ray took over at the same office, there wasn't any games in the office. It was very tidy, very neat, very official, very proper. But there was no playing, you know, and that was not a good sign.
He did want to do one game, polo.
Yeah. A polo cartridge, he'd sell that one a lot, yeah. So.
The real shame, though, was that Nolan, that the two personalities couldn't have been bridged, because they really were the two elements of building something that really was sustainable, and that was the sad part.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That's more common question. Guys feel vindicated and proud, but despite the fact that the story of Atari ends somewhat sadly, you were right, you did change the world. Kids today are doing totally different things than they did before you guys started. And that's that adults do, actually, now in the 20s and 30s. Yeah. And I hope that's a good feeling, because you deserve it.
Tell my wife that. She was one of the originals on the electric company in Sesame Street, so we'd have this split, you know, game's good for you, game's not good for you. You know, during the courtship, you have to appear to be sensitive. And so I said, not all the games are violent, and, you know, some are cooperative. You know, so we did the hook and ladder truck game. You know, somebody's in the front driving the... It sold seven of them or something like that. And I was in the back. So she was driving the front, and I was in the back, and we were cooperating. I'm hitting over the head. No, turn left, turn right.
Discussing this between the sessions here is that what I hope you understand, that you probably do, but it's something that gets overlooked, is that at the time that Atari was coming out and Commodore was coming out with 20, and we couldn't afford the ST at the time, all my friends really were doing a lot of stuff, and I was up with the 40 by 20 screen resolution, no shift key, which was very bizarre. But at that time, and being a kid, you were able to give them something that the medium did, which is control. They gave them control over their environment, they gave them control over something that allowed them to build something which they could not do in any other medium. We're seeing that in a much more macro way today with the internet and the form of communication. And that's really what the Gainsview has done.
What was actually interesting, when we were so busy doing it, you don't really see the bigger implications. I mean, really, it was a way to make a lot of money. We're going to do it. It was nice consequence of that. But in a bigger sense, indeed, television before, really, the Magnavox Odyssey game was the first, but really, home Pong was the first thing people hooked to their television set that wasn't an antenna. There was no cable TV. There were no VCRs. So in a way, in the McLuhan sense, it turned television from a cold medium where you sat back and you just absorb something to where now, if you didn't do something, the screen just stopped. And it changed the medium. Now, I got to tell you, that wasn't our plan. Our plan was to make money and have fun to make money. But it did do that, and forever. And indeed, I will argue personal computers, as we know them, sprang from that group and that idea and that thing. And also it was neat to watch Woz pick up how we did cheap tricks with color TV really quick, and there, boom, there's the Apple II color. So I'm really proud of that, that in a way, Pong and Atari existed because of what we learned at Ampex, doing it the right way, and then we did it the cheap way in a different marketplace, and then to see Apple spring out of that, that's a great part of it. I don't feel that a theft at all, because they actually offered us the product, and they offered us the Apple II computer. And in my infinite wisdom, I told Joe and Nolan, I said, you know, it's a nice thing. I'd like it, but I'm a nerd. There's no software for it. It doesn't really do anything. And we're so busy building these things, I don't think it's going to sell. But Jobs wants to talk to you anyhow. Give him a listen, you know. And that didn't work out at all. They never got along very well at all. And that's what happened. He says, he kicked me out of the office. And so that was the end of that.
I think that was the other contribution of Atari, is it became the two kids in a garage starting up. And as Al said, that Apple came out of Atari. So the Silicon Valley story was actually the other great output from the Atari experience.
Right.
I'm sorry, then the question I had is, if you can lay the room to rest, you don't have to, it's going to put anyone on the spot, but is it true that when the Tremails first walked into Atari, they were playing Darth Vader's Death March?
as is most rumors, there's some element of truth. And there was one building I want to say was 875 Gibraltar, but don't quote me on that exactly. It was something 75. And it was a building full of programmers. And when Leonard Trammell and what was his buddy, the Tragic Desk guy, John Fagans. When Leonard Trammell and John Fagans walked in the front door of 875 Gibraltar, someone over the loudspeaker said, "The Imperial Stormtroopers have entered the building." There weren't too many people left from 875 because those guys had no sense of humor. But, you know, that's true. I also, an interesting fact, you were talking about the Apple II. I don't know if anyone knows this or not, but the NES was offered to Atari. Atari named the Sega Genesis, and the Sega Genesis was offered to Atari. And our Chicago office named it. So, well, yeah, but that's a different story. It wasn't, the Amiga wasn't offered to us.
Right.
The Amiga was developed and with Atari money, and then the Amiga guys came and said, "Hey, Jack, man, this thing just doesn't work, man. Here's your check back." And Jack, of course, took the check and put it in his pocket. But no, it was essentially an Atari product.
Right.
But that's a whole other thing I'd rather not get into.
Yeah.
What were the differences between Ralph Baer's version of Pong and
That's a good question. Ralph Baer's version of Pong was really the best you could do with the technology at the time. It didn't use digital logic as such. There were digital switching going on, but it was fundamentally, in my opinion, an analog game. So it played differently, and it really didn't, I don't think, had quite the play value. But the one thing that Ralph Baer did do that I give him, take nothing away from. I mean, he really, he was the first guy to build a box that hooked to the TV set. It wasn't, you know, and so he blazed that ground. So when I made a home version of Pong, you know, it was already, they said, "Well, you can't do that." Well, hell, Magnavox is doing that part, you know. So that took a lot of courage. That was a new class of product to solve all those problems. So in general, the thing obviously didn't have the play value, didn't sell very well. But I beg your pardon? The Magnavox Odyssey game, well, we can go back to the court record. When Nolan signed the book at the demo show in mid to early 1972, when Magnavox finally released it, the patents that Mr. Baer wrote, I believe, were filed in like 69, 70, so it took a few years to get into production. So it was in the 70 or 72 it was introduced.
Yeah.
That must have been. I never actually went to that show, but apparently Nolan did.
But also, Pong being introduced, the Atari Pong being introduced in a coin-op location had the advantage of building a market slowly,
right,
because to bring it out as a consumer device,
right,
consumer devices, you need maybe 2% of the population or more to understand what it's about beforehand,
before
it can really take off. So by building the, I guess, 20, maybe 40,000 Pongs that were built coin up?
Well, we built about 3,000 or 4,000 of them. There were about 10,000 built. Everybody ripped them off. But it gave a chance for the... Yeah, absolutely. It was on Saturday Night Live. I mean, that was amazing. Imagine, here I'm a 24-year-old kid, and I go do something, this Pong thing, and the next thing I know, I'm watching Saturday Night Live, and there's a skit involving it had become part of the culture at that point in time. So, yeah, what Steve is saying, now you offer the same thing in the home, people could get it. They understood what that was about, what the play value experience would be. All you do is figure out, hook it up to the back of the TV set at that time.
And Al's version of Pong for coin-op also had the advantage that you could put your beer on the top of the cabinet.
Yes, and your cigarette and your beer. And I remember a funny story. I got to tell you, at the end of my tenure at Atari, I got a letter, a copy of a letter that had gone from like Shumway Debakey, a great heart surgeon in Africa, and he had mailed it to Steve Ross, the chairman of Warner, which went to the Benny Girard, the president of Warner, which went to Ray Kassar, which went to me, saying basically Americans need more exercise. There's no exercise in video games. Can't we do a video game that has like a paddle or treadle or a treadmill or something to get people to get their hearts better? And so I answered it in a one-pager and copied everybody at once so it didn't go right, they couldn't stop it. And I basically said that Pong, you're missing the point. Pong was designed so you could participate in athletics while maintaining a firm grip on a can of beer. Go out and play tennis. Play ping pong. You know, I refuse to do it. And I never got any more of those letters after that. I stopped sending them.
I have a question for the gentleman on the right. Before Sam Tramiel's heart attack, was there anything that he had planned for Atari to turn around and say that
what? 95 million. And well, they were taking money before. I mean, yeah, that was they were hurting. The 5 million that the Hasbro sale, they had already borrowed against that before that check had even come in. So I mean, yeah, it was come and gone. Thanks a lot. See ya. Kind of a thing. What we were trying to do, I mean, there was a basic problem I feel in the company, which is a misunderstanding of the needs of marketing, and the misunderstanding of the needs of giving a person a reason to buy a product that they don't eat, they don't wear, and they don't live in. And the Tramiels tended to just say, if I give you a good price. I mean, there were some things we did. I mean, God, there's a movie out right now called AVP. Gosh, it's Aliens and Predators. Think about that. What a concept. You know, where'd that come from? You know, we were doing stuff, but it was always in the paper. Troubled Atari, troubled this, troubled that. You know, people, you know, we weren't getting the message out as well as we could have because that cost money. And they were not willing to do that. And frankly, not willing to give you, the purchaser, a warm fuzzy about what you were buying. I mean, you know, pre Tramiel Atari, I mean, you know, like you said, $100 million to, you know, you had Alan Alda, who never said it was good or not, but at least you had Alan Alda saying something. You know, you had a sense of Atari community. You had a sense of hey, we're all in this and we're all having a good old time.
Well, you still have a sense of Atari community, don't you?
Well, absolutely now. You know, in spite of Atari, right. You know, in terms of senior management, you know, there's still that sense of community because I think the underlying spirit of the people actually working on this stuff somehow like leaked into the product and transcended what management tried or tried not to do.
Yeah. Well, but the other important thing, too, is prior to Sam's heart attack, the Midsummer project, which was basically Jaguar 2, was well underway. And that was Jaguar with real triangle setup and this wacky concept of bilinear filtering, which was post-PlayStation 1 but still pre-Nintendo 64. And, you know, and there was working, you know, there was working hardware up and running for that with Jaguar games that were just magically inheriting bilinear filtering, which was a very, very cool thing.
And texture mapping.
Right.
Yeah.
Gosh. And, you know, so all of, you know, all of those kind of things also hit the skids when Sam had the heart attack. So. Well, the last license, you know, among some of the big last license deals that were done were the Frank Thomas Big Hurt Baseball,
right?
Mortal Kombat,
right?
And a lot of, and there was a
NBA
lot of
Jam,
yeah, NBA was, Jam. There was a lot of stuff also.
NBA Jam 2.
Mortal Kombat 3 ever finished with Atari?
No. But also, there was a lot of cooperative work going back and forth at the time with Atari Games. you know, because Area 51 had been built on Jaguar, and then they were also, you know, looking at the next generation Primal Rage and things like that, and kicking around what could be done. And a lot of the, you know, a lot of the input from the team at Atari Games with Brian McKee and those guys, John Matheson and the engineers at Atari were taking that back and folding a lot of that stuff back into what might have someday been Jaguar 2. And you know, and again, the, you know, when you say, you know, I think what you're getting at is what effect did the heart attack really have? I think a lot of that did. I mean, Sam, you know, Sam was the guy with arcade hardware in his den at his house and things like that. I mean, Jaguar was Sam's passion. Right. For all of the times that Jack wanted to kill Jaguar, because Jack used to look at Jaguar in Game Gear, and I can remember how frustrated he was, because he was just racking his brains out over, he said, you know, somehow or another, Sega is wrapping a $15 bill around every single Game Gear that was going out there. And as it all turned out, it wound up being that, yeah, the display that Sega was putting in Game Gear was roughly $15 less than the display in the Lynx. So Jack could identify, Jack was capable of identifying a problem and coming to a conclusion still faster to this day than I've ever seen, and he looked at it and said, "There's no way we're ever going to be able to compete against Game Gear." And he always used to argue with Sam, and Sam said, "Well, you know, maybe." And part of the genesis, no pun intended, of Jaguar was, Sam said, "Well, you know, maybe they're funding Game Gear out of Genesis," which was yet another reason that he gave to everybody why we should do Jaguar. You know, it was so that Jaguar could help support Lynx and everything else. You know, but Sam was just utterly passionate about, you know, being in the video games industry and thinking that it was a cool thing for Atari to be doing.
Yeah, of the family, Sam was the video game guy,
right.
Totally the game guy.
You know, and Jack was the guy that would constantly look at it and say, "It's just not making financial sense." You know, so. Well, because he knew that we were going to get our butt kicked by the Taiwanese, you know, by Taiwan, you know, Taiwanese PC manufacturers, you know, which nowadays are, you know, the Asus Techs and MSIs and those guys that are building motherboards for everybody and their brother. Oh yeah, I mean, Jack, like I said, from a financial standpoint, Jack could look at the financial landscape of where things were at. I mean, you know, Jack could open up a PC. And, you know, calculate the bill of materials cost in a heartbeat,
right.
And know that this, you know, oh my gosh, they're cutting these corners, they're cutting those corners, and sure enough, I mean, even IBM wound up fundamentally pulling out of the PC industry for a while after having done the PS2 and stuff like that, for all of the reasons that Jack predicted.
So there was a brief stint where Atari was producing IBM
PC games, right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was an attempt again to generate revenue, going into an Atari Soft type of thing with Atari Interactive. We had Ted Hoff come in and start rolling on that, to where we would be again platform agnostic. And try and spread development costs across more than one platform, which is, you know, what a lot of companies do. It's a typical model, and you know, just a sort of a logical extension. I mean, Atari Soft was doing that back.
Right.
When?
I mean, and the funny thing about it, yeah, I mean, Atari Soft was, you know, had done Apple II stuff, right?
Sure.
But also the other thing around that time is Sam had me talking to Bernie Stoller at Sony about possibly Atari even becoming a PlayStation licensee at that time. Well, it had a heart attack, is what it
had.
Yeah,
it had a heart attack. Yeah,
right. Yeah,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah, it was just starting. I mean, you know, one of the things I was doing while I was doing the licensing, was unraveling some of the deals that we had just started to get going. You know, software development costs have gone through the roof. I mean, I was talking to somebody last night at the dinner we had. Tempest 2000 was I think the last game, or at least last game I'm aware of, where I was the producer, Jeff Minter was the programmer, we had three musicians and an artist part-time. That was it. Did it in 6 weeks. There was no arguments. There was no problems. It was just one of the sweetest things that I've ever been involved with. It was just absolute fun. But today, you know, you've got the cast of thousands. And a cast of thousands costs thousands more to do. So you've got to spread your development cost across, you know, more platforms than just one. Especially, you know, if you're the sole supporter of a platform, you know, your platform, and, you know, everybody's kind of waiting to see what you're doing, and, you know, you're not getting Madden anytime soon. You know, so you've got to cover all the genres. You yourself have to be the sports franchise and the action game franchise and the driving franchise and the flying franchise, and, you know, you got to do it all. Now, that requires a pretty darn big wallet, number one. So, you know, you got to start thinking about what else you can do. And if you're going to be spending the time and effort to develop a kick-ass product, you might as well look at leveraging that across other systems as well. I mean, and, you know, there was no at that point, too, I think it became less bad, for want of a better word, to not be platform exclusive. I mean, you know, you didn't need to be a Sonic. You know, I mean, it was cool, and we were always looking for something like that. But, you know, a baseball game is a baseball game, and if you can do a really good one and you know, leverage across other systems, why not?
For those of you who worked on VCS, what did you think about the 8-bit Nintendo and its success?
Okay. As I said, Nintendo was actually brought to Atari and passed on it. I think the success, you know, Nintendo did a brilliant job for two reasons. One, Atari had this brand. We made incredibly quality products within the technical limitations of the VCS, and there was a brand loyalty. Then what happened was Atari switched over from seeing their assets of not being the best programmers, the best gamers. Their assets were the best marketeers. So they brought out a series of really bad products and bad cartridges and killed the brand. Just absolutely destroyed it. It was going to go through decline anyhow, because the game industry is, it's almost biblical. It goes on the 7-year fast cycles. You know, so it was due for retrenchment, but there was so much bad product out for the VCS that it just destroyed the category. Part of the problem was the bad products that were brought out by Atari. And I think in a previous session they talked about it, that there was this tremendous demand. You know, we have this Christmas schedule. These products have to go out, and we know they're going to sell because we're going to put, you know, $5 million of advertising behind this product, and we can stuff the channel. So we destroyed the channel. We destroyed the consumer trust in the Atari name. There was also all these other companies that some of the other companies like Activision were putting out quality products, but there was just so much junk out there that it destroyed the industry. NES, besides having a wonderful technical platform, they decided to build the product up slowly. Just like we said, where Pong, the coin-op Pong, allowed reestablishing the, you know, the product and the awareness, NES first restricted the number of products that could go out to ensure quality, and then just brought it out first in New York and Los Angeles and reestablished the quality of the product and reestablished with the distributors that they could make money at this. And the implementation was incredibly cost-effective, and it was a superb implementation. But they did in terms of rebuilding a whole industry was just incredible.
You were there at the time. I had left early, so I'll stand on your remarks.
Okay, another piece of that, too, was that the Nintendo had created the ROB, Robotic Buddy. The whole idea behind building a component is at the time, no
buyer. You buy a video game, you buy a toy. Mm-hmm. If you had a toy in it and you marketed it as a toy, people picked it up and when they got it home, they realized, oh, it's also a video game. And it was the only way they could get it entrenched in the market as quickly as they could.
Another thing happened that changed the rules between Atari and Nintendo, and it was the government change and the IBM and AT&T antitrust. Atari tried putting in security, you know, and so that only Atari cartridges could play with the Atari games, and our lawyers said that we couldn't do that because we had such a large market share, we were going to get our butts sued. But the whole regulatory community changed during that period of time, so Nintendo could put in their security and say only Nintendo products could work, you know, or approved products go in. That first happened with, I think, Apple II had some of the changes in the laws where they said only certain people could sell Apple IIs. And also Nintendo about that time. So the rules changed so that Nintendo could participate not only in the hardware cost, but a vast percentage of the software cost, so that they could now make money on both sides and afford to keep the quality up.
Yeah.
When Atari was about to go under, did anybody think that, they sold the name for $5 million, but actually, you know, finding a large game company and to do something with it, that's what it's involved.
So from the Trammell perspective, though, you've got to remember that these guys had been up and down with it for, you know, roughly 10 years at that point, right?
Yeah.
And I think that so much of it had to do with, we're okay, and I think fundamentally one of the reasons that Sam was willing to do the deal with Hasbro so readily is I think he in his heart felt that Hasbro would take reasonably good care of it, right? And it's kind of weird because even, you know, with guys at Hasbro at the time like John Sutak and John Hurlbut, they really did kind of have that mindset to the point that when things were getting a little rocky for Hasbro with the whole Hasbro Interactive and the Atari brands over there, I can remember, you know, talking to those guys in the industry at the time when they sold it to Infogram. One of the reasons that they sold it to Infogram was that in their hearts they felt that the Atari name would continue, and lo and behold, Bruno goes ahead and turns Atari, you know, turns the company name back into Atari. So, you know, it's always been there's always been this nugget of heart with Atari wherever it's gone. And I think from the Trammell standpoint, they just kind of looked at it as an exit strategy. Not even so much from a money standpoint, but just from this is the right time, you know, right time to get out and just hand it off to somebody else. And they kind of thought that Hasbro would do probably more with it than what they did. But again, the one thing that they did do is make sure that the people at Hasbro took reasonable care of the name and the properties while they were there. So
right. You have to understand too that you know, if you look at like a chip company, okay, you're talking silicon, and your cost of goods is not that great up front. So if you have a good yield, you know, you can make additional profits. But you look at a hard drive, I mean, you know, God help anybody that gets in the hard drive business, because you've got a lot of very expensive, very precise components that cost you a lot of money up front. Then you put it in your warehouse, you hand it off to a distributor, maybe they pay you in 30 days, maybe they pay you in 90 days. But yet you've got, you know, 80-90% of the money involved in that drive invested in it already. So I mean it's an ugly business. I mean, I don't know. I mean, you know, it's a wonderful commodity. I love my hard drive, but boy, I'd never want to work making another one again.
This sort of saves it away from your last the last question that was asked is kind of rough. What are your personal thoughts and opinions on Infogrames resurrecting the Atari name? Do you feel that it's...
I've been working with those people a lot recently because of my involvement with all of the Unreal products and Unreal Tournament and things like that, and NVIDIA has a really close relationship with Epic Games and Atari, and fundamentally I think that they have that they've carried the torch forward as reasonably well as they possibly can. Is it likely in the next 10 years that there's going to be yet another inflection? Yeah, probably. But as far as recognizing the catalog that they've got and things like that, I think that, I think over the years you're going to see them do more and more with it. And, frankly, at the time that it all happened, I can't think of another company that would have had the capital necessary to be able to pull that deal off. Because that was a really, in between, around the time frame that happened, there were a lot of companies just overall afraid of making any big moves in the video game business. So,
but boy, is it strange seeing Atari ads on TV again. Very interesting.
I would hope the Atari legacy isn't the T-shirts and the back catalog and things like that.
Right.
But the sense of going ahead and trying to do interesting games and experimenting and broadening the market rather than and then going back and and mining what was there 20 years ago or 30 years ago. So I hope that if anybody does, if the Atari name does exist, in the future, it's going to be about new products and new games and whole new game concepts.
Yeah, innovation instead of just
rehash.
It ain't your father's Atari kind of thing. Yeah, yeah.
On that same point, first of all,
Wally
Atari legacy is all relevant. I'm an engineer because I have Atari. That's why I'm an engineer. And I know a lot of people like that. So I'm too much credit for that Atari people. That is the reason I went into this field. And so I'd say there's a whole lot of Atari legacy out there.
No, thank you.
Yeah. It's beautiful. It's really beautiful. The Grass Valley Research Labs. And I asked William Bushnell about that smoking story. And he said that it was not a mystery at all. The clouds were around the building. It did, and I seriously didn't know it. any neat products that came out of there that you talked to Bell Silver and never did?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
I mean that what Steve was talking about, the idea that you could fail, and when people talk about innovated, and I've given talks about innovation in a corporate environment, which is very hard to do, and they talk about the success of the VCS, the June CES in 77 was a fabulous thing to be at, where we introduced the Atari VCS. It was the hit of the show. It was one of the most exciting events in my life to see this whole show turned around on this one product. People forget 6 months earlier what was the product that Atari introduced at the January CES. It was video music. And we had that. We thought, like, wow, we're going to sell a bunch of these things, and it was just like, oh my God, we ordered 5,000 to be built. The original plan was 100,000. We said maybe 5. And manufacturing said this thing's such a stinker, we're not going to do it. They only built a few hundred or whatever, and every engineer has one in their closet to this day. But that was a failure, and you know what? Nobody was criticized. Nobody lost their job. Nobody had any, deduction. We celebrated those kind of things. We used to have the Golden Turkey Award, the dumbest thing that was done in the last month. We give out an award for that sort of stuff. So yeah, there were a lot of mistakes. We had so many mistakes, and that's because we were innovative. The only way you can be innovative is you've got to be able to have mistakes. If you're not allowed to make mistakes, it's not going to be innovative. That's real simple. So yeah, we had tons of them. Yeah, up to a point, absolutely. It was a lot of fun.
Okay. And not a single.
And Microsoft thinks it's pretty neat inside Windows Media Player too.
The VCS?
No, no, yeah, no, no, VLM was in Jaguar.
Yeah, VLM's in Jaguar. Oh, yeah.
Well, we had made a custom chip. I mean, there was a lot of money in this thing, and we had, and Harold was the engineer that did it, and Harold was kind of counterculture, shall we say, even for Atari standards, so we did not introduce Harold to the buyer at Sears during the Pong episode. But once Pong was a big success, we felt free to introduce the two of them, and that led to this episode with the, anyway.
There was a lot of counterculture stories. When Sears first came out, they came out in their suits and ties. Hal and Nolan were in the blue jeans.
No, what happened was, okay, I got Pong chip to work. I mean, it was like, wow, this is going to actually work. We can build this thing. And then we said, well, how are we going to sell this? So somebody said, consumer, doesn't Sears, they're a big retailer. Yeah, okay. They had a big building in Chicago. We called and got them. And we found Tom Quinn, who was the buyer in sporting goods that was selling the Magnavox Odyssey game. And we talked to Tom. He happened to be in. And we said, we described what we had. And he said, sounds interesting. The next time I'm out in California, I'll stop it and see you. 3 days later, he was at our doorstep in Los Gatos at 8 o'clock in the morning with a suit and tie. None of us were. I showed up at about 9, and I wasn't wearing a suit and tie, and they said, there's this guy in a suit out there from Sears. Oh, my God. He came out already. So I quick did something and entertained him. And then finally Joe and Nolan show up later on, and we did this thing, and he was very uneasy. But it was a huge shift in culture. I mean, you had a very almost army mentality from Chicago, regimented 8 o'clock, 5 o'clock, and then you had Atari, which get the job done. I don't care if you show up. Just do the job. It's his fault.
Okay. We said if you work back and say $200 retail, you know, and then you start working back, you end up with a hardware budget of about $25 to $30.
Right.
So that set the thing.
No frame buffer.
So we that allowed a certain amount. It came out $9 for the computer and for the graphics and for the plastic around it and everything. And there was no computer at the time that could possibly meet that requirement. Except we went to a Westcon show, and there was Commodore with selling computers.
MOS technology.
MOS technology, yeah. Mm-hmm. Which is, and was selling computers by the barrel. And you could, there was this one barrel full of these chips that were going to be $8 to $9, that's Chuck Peddle's design. And we got excited. So that made the VCS possible to meet the cost point. What we didn't realize was they were selling it by the barrel, but they only had one barrel in the whole world. So Al arranged in working with...
Well, let me tell that story. Okay. So what happened was the 6502 was clearly the miracle that made this thing possible because it was very fast at the time, and it was made by this little company, MOS Technology, back on the East Coast that was struggling. At the same time, Jack Tramiel's Commodore was buying CMOS chips from these guys. He was putting them out of business. So it wound up, they tried to sell it to me. Warner would let me buy the company. Only $1 million. I could have had my own foundry. But anyway, so now it got bought by Jack Tramiel. The company is owned by Jack, and they're the only people making this processor. And Joe Keenan came to me. I said, here's the prototype. Isn't it wonderful? Look at the games. And he says, the processor is 6502. Yeah. And it's sole source to Jack Tramiel? Yeah. He says, no, we're not going to do that. You tell me how fast will it work with a 6800? And I said, well, we can move it one tank very slowly. And so I said, look, let me cut a deal. So I went to MOS Technology and Jack, and I said, look, how many do you want to sell me? He said, like a half a million, or whatever number. I said, great. I guarantee we'll buy that at that price, but only if I can get a second source. So I got Synertec and Western Digital up as second sources, and we all made a lot of money. And by what a happenstance, this other little company had sprung out of Atari called Apple, they happened to use the same microprocessor. So we were selling, these guys were selling more microprocessors, 6502, than Intel and Motorola put together for quite a long time.
We're about to, okay.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks.